Hello, and welcome to the inaugural episode of the Poor Grammar School podcast. I am James Shilling.
I'm Owen Wilson-Drain.
I'm Luke Nyagu.
I'm Logan O'Brien.
And this is Lucinda Dickens Hawksley, a descendant of the one, the only, Charles Dickens.
Hello, it's really lovely to be here.
Oh, fantastic. So obviously, we've come up with a few questions to ask you, obviously, about your ancestor. Who wants to start?
All right, so the first question I want to ask is, what's your favourite adaptation of Christmas Carol? You know, movie or otherwise, which one's the most faithful? Have you seen The Muppets Christmas Carol?
I have seen The Muppets Christmas Carol, and it's actually very faithful to the text, which surprises a lot of people. I like the old classic, the black and white, the Alistair Sim Scrooge version.
Oh, absolutely.
And I also like the Disney one that Jim Carrey did about 12, 13 years ago, whenever it was. It was also really faithful to the text.
I think it was 2009 that came out, so 15 years old now.
Wow, is it really 15 years? Now I feel really old. Thank you for that, James. I feel really old now. but yes, it's really faithful to the text. And what I don't like is when adaptations leave out the two children, ignorance and want. I've seen adaptations that do that, and it's frustrating because they were the crux of why Dickens wrote A Christmas Carol. It was all about child poverty.
Yeah.
So anything that keeps those in gets my vote, and anything that appeals to a new audience. So I thought The Muppets Christmas Carol was excellent because it got children interested in it.
Yeah, that's
wonderful. Thank you. That's understandable. Okay, so our next question is, I was wondering, do you feel you would have become an author if it weren't for your family's history?
Yes, I think I would always have been an author. I always wanted to write, even when I was very little and I didn't really know much about Dickens. In fact, I knew that I was related to him, but what I didn't know when I was little was that he was famous. Okay. So I just thought people knew him in my family. I always wanted to write from very small childhood onwards, and that's mostly down to two authors who weren't Dickens, Roald Dahl and Penelope Lively, whose books I loved and read again and again and again. And there's lots of actors in my family. There's very few writers, strangely. There's lots of people who've gone into editing and journalism from the editorial side in books and journalism. Not that many writers, which is really strange, but there are a lot of actors. And Dickens was a very keen actor, so that gene has come down really strong.
Yeah. You mentioned certain authors like Roald Dahl. Are there any books that stand out for you, maybe as a child, that could have shaped or influenced how you write now?
That's a really interesting question. I liked things that had history in, and I write about history. There was a book by Penelope Lively called The Ghost of Thomas Kemp, and I absolutely loved that book. I must have read it 100 times. I also really liked E. Nesbitt, actually, who was writing a long time beforehand, and certain books like The Railway Children, which I absolutely loved, but Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, James and the Giant Peach, and The Magic Finger were my favourite.
Yeah,
favourite Roald Dahl books. And I would say that The Magic Finger is probably the book that turned me vegetarian, so my parents probably weren't pleased about it.
Yeah,
it's generally quite interesting because I think I speak for most of us here, when we also grew up in Roald Dahl, obviously, I think.
Did we?
Yeah.
I think we all sort of grew up in Roald Dahl, so it's generally quite interesting to see how sort of that's become like multi-generational in the same way Dickens has.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and a brilliant writer, and for the same reason he's still revered over different generations, no matter what people think about his private life. There's a lot of discussion about Roald Dahl's private life, but his books are so brilliant because, like Dickens, they're really plot-driven and really character-driven. So you know when you read a Roald Dahl book, you're going to find out all sorts of fascinating things about the characters. Yeah. And the same with Dickens, and they both use grotesque characters as well.
Yeah.
Which, let's face it, children love. They love to read about the twits or, you know, the witches and all these
characters. I was
going to
say, I grew up with the twits.
Yeah. I mean, Roald Dahl's books were genius, as were Dickens, because you can just get somebody, if you get somebody reading, there's a lot of snobbery about books and, oh, children shouldn't read this. I mean, I knew when I was reading Enid Blyton as a child, I loved Enid Blyton. I knew, although I wouldn't have known the words for it, that she was racist and sexist. I felt that she was writing at a time that was my grandmother's era.
Yeah.
I don't think I read them and became a racist because I'd read Enid Blyton. You know, I was always aware that what she wrote was wrong. But you read them, as children are much more intelligent than adults give them any credit for.
Absolutely,
and I think you do decide for yourself, well, I don't agree with that view, but this was written, you know, 30 years ago or 40 years ago, whatever it might be. And I just think anything you can get a child to read and enjoy reading, that will imbue them with a love of reading that will stay throughout their life. So my nephew wouldn't read anything until he discovered comic books, and then he just loved reading. That's so important, to get that love of being able to go into a whole other world. And now he writes songs. He's a really good writer of lyrics. he would never read books. We couldn't get him to read a book at all as a child, but once he discovered comic books, it worked.
Yeah. Mm, thank you. Obviously, we've spoken about potentially Dickens having an influence over you being an author, and you've spoken about how, even since you were a very young child, you always loved writing.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel, how does it feel to have such a prominent ancestor like Dickens?
It's really fascinating to be related to someone like Dickens, because everybody knows who he is. It's quite extraordinary. Sometimes when I go travelling and I'll be in a country and they'll look at my passport and say, "Are you related to Charles Dickens?" Which never happens in Britain, by the way. No one's ever interested in my passport when I come back home. But I'm always amazed by how well he's known in countries I just wouldn't have expected him to be known in. I met a delegation of people from South Korea at the London Book Fair some years ago, and they got really excited because I'd just written a book about Dickens and Christmas. They weren't excited about Christmas, they were excited about Dickens. And apparently he's hugely popular in South Korea. I went to Croatia some years ago, and at the hotel I was in, they sort of said, "Oh, you're related to Dickens, and I love Dickens, and we learnt him at school." And I thought, I wouldn't even know the name of a Croatian author, which made me feel very ignorant compared to the man I was talking to, worked in this hotel and read Dickens because he loved him. It's fascinating how Dickens connects people around the world. And I also find it really interesting how, no matter which side of the political spectrum a government is on, countries always like to identify with Dickens. Whether they're left-wing or right-wing, they like to identify with his values. And that really fascinates me, because two different political spectra, and yet they will agree with his views.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a really good lead on to our next question, actually. How do you feel about his, or what do you think his particular political views were? Because obviously there are quite a few bits of his writing that are fairly leftist, such as A Christmas Carol, obviously being about child poverty. So how in particular do you feel about his political views?
We know that Dickens was what he described as a radical. So today would be called left wing.
Yeah.
He was asked to become an MP a couple of times. He didn't want to, partly because he wanted to concentrate on his writing, but also he was quite savvy. He knew that if he allied himself to one political party, he would lose all the readers from the other party and their supporters. Mm. But crucially, Dickens felt that he could do more good with his writing than he could by being a politician. And he did manage to change the world in which he lived through his writing. So Dickens would see a cause that people would tell him about. He often said he wasn't the first person to know about a cause, but people would tell him, and if he really felt moved by it, he would take on that cause. So, for example, in the early 1850s, he got approached by a group of medics who asked him if he would help them because they wanted to set up a children's hospital. Now, to us, that doesn't seem like a radical idea, but this was the first children's hospital in Britain, Great Ormond Street Hospital, and there was no hospital for children. Children's medicine was just ignored, and that's why so many children died. And Dickens took this on as a really important cause, helped to fundraise for it. He wrote articles explaining why people should take their children to this new hospital that was set up specifically for children. Through that, he managed to basically create Great Ormond Street Hospital as the place it is today. It's a phenomenal legacy. He found out about the deaths of miners in Doncaster, and he went up to Doncaster and he wrote about the deaths of miners that had been caused by young children working in the mine. And what these children had to do was to ventilate the mine. They had to open one trapdoor, close the other one, and then vice versa. And they were little children. We're talking kind of 5, 6, 7 years old. And the lives of all those miners were in their hands. Dickens discovered how awful this accident was, how many people had died, went up and researched it and wrote an article about it. He got that into the public domain. He was always on the side of the underdog. He considered himself to have been one of those. His father had been an imprisoned debtor. He had been a child labourer. Now, those weren't things that he discussed. People didn't talk about it then. It was seen as really... Well, you would have lost his reputation had they known that he was the son of an imprisoned debtor and that he'd been a child labourer. Now it would be part of your kind of, your kudos, really. But what he did was he always sought to change those kind of conditions.
Yeah, I was wondering more specifically about Christmas Carol and Scrooge himself.
Mm-hmm.
I've recently read about many critics who described him as embodying quite a few Jewish stereotypes, and I'd be really interested to hear your perceptions on that.
Well, Scrooge, that's interesting. I've never actually heard that said before. Ebenezer Scrooge came out of Dickens's research into misers. He particularly found this book fascinating, which is called The Lives of the Misers, and I cannot remember the name of the author, but he also references it in Bleak House and Our Mutual Friend. He has people reading this particular book. So Dickens gets a lot of grief for his depiction of Fagin in Oliver Twist. He was accused of being anti-Semitic, yeah. And in his own yeah. time. Dickens actually based the character of Fagin on a specific Jewish East End criminal called Ikey Solomons, who was transported to Australia. And when a friend of Dickens, a neighbour of his who was Jewish, she wrote to him, her name was Eliza Davis, and she said, "My community thinks that you are anti-Semitic, and I don't think that you are." He was really shocked to discover that people thought his portrayal of Fagin was meant to be representative of all Jewish people. That wasn't what he'd expected at all. So in Our Mutual Friend, he wrote a new character, Mr. Ryer. And Mr. Ryer is one of Dickens' nicest characters. And that was Dickens' apology to the Jewish community. And in that, we see that Mr. Ryer is believed by most people to be the moneylender. He's Jewish. He's used as the front. He's very physically beaten and abused by the Christian who is the moneylender. And Dickens subverted people's opinion of Jewish moneylenders through this book, and Mr. Ryer is exonerated. But I've never heard people say that about Scrooge. More supposed to be more influenced by Scotland, and there was always this kind of, you know, joke that Scottish people were more tight with money than English. But again, that's also turns out to be a complete hoax. Dickens was alleged to have seen a gravestone in Edinburgh with the name of Ebenezer Scroggie on it, and that was where he took the name from. But the Scottish archives say absolutely no record of this grave ever. It's just something that was kind of made up in about the 1920s. And people believe, I've heard Edinburgh City Guides give that, but it's not actually true. I think Scrooge was probably a combination of the people his father owed money to and people that he had encountered in his time as a journalist. He saw a lot of things when he was in the law courts. He was really concerned about debtors. So I think that's a fascinating... I've never heard that critique of Scrooge, but I must look up that research, obviously. But I don't think he was inspired by... I don't think he was meant to be Jewish in any way.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Philip.
Cool. So next I want to ask, how far do you think, or do you think it's all that Dickens' works are maybe sometimes overvalued, or maybe put on a pedestal a little too much?
That's a really interesting question. I mean, I'm obviously bound to say, I don't think they're overvalued at all, because I've just become president of the Dickens Fellowship. But I would say that Dickens wrote 5 Christmas books. And in his own time, Christmas Carol was just the first. In his own time, they were all adored. However, I don't think that the other 4 are anything like as good as A Christmas Carol. The last one, The Haunted Man, is my second favourite. I love it. The middle 3, Cricket on the Hearth, The Battle of Life, and The Chimes, I just think that I would have edited them all. Now, I'm probably going to get in big trouble for saying that, but as I started out as a book editor, and sometimes when I read them, I think, oh, we're not getting to the crux of the story here. We know that also that Dickens was paid by the word when he was a journalist, so he did like to to write to the full word count. But in his own time, these books were absolutely adored. Each one was more popular than the one the year before, so when The Chimes came out in 1844, it outsold Christmas Carol of the previous year. Mm. But I think that most of Dickens' novels, I actually think his novels are astonishing, his major novels. Hard Times is not my favourite, but the one that I think is underrated, that is never read by most people, is Barnaby Rudge, which I think deserves to have more appreciation than it does today. I just think his works are astonishing because they were written in what people felt at the time was really dumbed down populist language. Now people think they're too hard, but when you get to the essence of the story and the plot, I think they're great. But yeah, the middle 3 Christmas books are not my faves.
Mm. Okay.
I was going to say, one of the works of Dickens I think is most underrated is The Signalman, because we don't really talk about that much in school, because obviously it's more of a gothic horror, and to be honest, most of the only real reason why I know is because of an offhand line in Doctor Who.
Good old Doctor Who, educating our children.
But genuinely, I read it myself when I was about, I want to say, 9, and it really captured the imagination with just how incredible it was.
It's a brilliant, brilliant, so I'm so glad you brought that up. Signalman is one of Dickens's, I think, most atmospheric, amazing stories. And interestingly, like A Christmas Carol, it was written with real passion. Christmas Carol was written as his response to child poverty. The Signalman came about after Dickens nearly died in a train crash. Mm. And he was literally pulling dead and dying people out of the wreckage. That's why this ghost story, don't want to give too much away, but there is a ghost story that's involved with trains emerged in Dickens's imagination, and I think Like a Christmas Carol, it was written with absolute passion. Another one you might really enjoy is a Christmas short story. It's like a long short story that he wrote with Wilkie Collins. It came out in 1867, and it's called No Thoroughfare. It's very melodramatic. Wilkie Collins was very melodramatic, but it's a great kind of chase.
Do you think you could discuss a bit, sort of almost what you feel about Dickens' larger historical impact on literature in general, and how, obviously, with just how successful his stories were within England and obviously then around the rest of the world, how do you think those stories have impacted literature over the past few decades and hundreds of years?
I find it always astonishing how far-reaching Dickens's work is. It's staggering how many works reference Dickens. I mean, I just almost every book I pick up, somebody, either a character in it or a reference in the text, will be to Dickens, and sometimes in really unexpected quarters. I was just reading a book by Amor Towles, who is an American author. I don't know if you've read any of his books. His most famous one recently is Gentleman in Moscow. And I just read one called The Rules of Civility, and one of his characters becomes obsessed with Dickens and becomes obsessed with Great Expectations. And I didn't expect this in a book about 1920s America. He is held up as this level of kind of, you know, the most famous British author after Shakespeare. I think, unfortunately, sometimes it leads people to get fed up with having to study Dickens at school. Yeah. I actually like it when people come to Dickens on their own, or people who say to me, oh, I didn't read Dickens for years because I got put off him at school and then I came back to him as an adult and I love his work. But I like it when Dickens is taught to young people in a way that will make them want to explore more of his works. And it's astonishing to think how many authors must be obsessed by him to keep referencing him. And it's not only in fiction, it's in journalism. The number of times Dickens quotes are used in journalism or for headlines, you'll see a sporting headline that says it was the best of times or the worst of times.
Yeah.
You see the word Scrooge used a lot. You see the word Dickensian used a lot. Around Christmas time, you'll start getting references to the Cratchit family.
Yeah.
It's just really, really wide-reaching. And Miss Havisham gets referenced a lot too.
Mm.
So this characters that people know the names of without even knowing that they're aware that it's Dickens, and that always astonishes me. When I was travelling in India, the first time I went to India, I was amazed that literally every bookshop I went into had a special product section, but you know, the whole, what are they called?
Those display?
Thank you. The display cases that publishers sent out where you put a specific author's works, and everyone would have one devoted to Dickens. They'd also have Agatha Christie, Enid Blyton, and P.G. Woodhouse. So I thought anyone going into those bookshops in India and reading those and then coming to England for the first time would get a bit of a shock. But I asked somebody in the bookselling industry, you know, why do people in India really still want to read Dickens? And they said he's absolutely loved here. So it is incredibly far-reaching. I'm told he's adored in China and Japan. It's really amazing how far his reach is.
I kind of want to backtrack a bit on something you said a bit earlier about how oftentimes people are put off by Dickens because they have to study him in school.
Yeah.
Is it because you particularly think there's something intrinsic about potentially like slowly analysing a book over the course of, let's say, a month, 2 months, maybe three? Do you think there is particularly like sort of something about particularly classroom settings that can sometimes make a potentially incredible book like A Christmas Carol dull to some people?
A lot of it comes down to the teaching, and a lot of it is if you have a teacher who's passionate about the subject. If they're passionate about the subject, they'll pass that on to you. Some people, though, just don't enjoy reading or don't respond in the same way as they might do when they're older. I was completely put off George Orwell, who I've tried to get into, but being made to read Animal Farm at the age of 11, I was absolutely distressed by it. The whole concepts just terrified me. And even now, I find Orwell hard to read, and I think it's a pity when you get put off by something like that. I was really lucky that I had fantastic teachers for Dickens, and I didn't study much Dickens until I went to university, by which age I was fully ready to be taught and to learn. But it also just depends on the individual student. Something else might be going on in their life. It might resonate with something. Teaching a book like Dickens or Tess of the D'Urbervilles or whatever,
yeah,
there's bits in it that might affect people if they're going through stuff in their own life, and that can stay with you too. So I would say stick with them. 7 months isn't that long on a book.
Yeah. No. You mentioned earlier about obviously the impact, and especially on children stuff, that are studying the books or then discovering the books through just finding it and reading it and really enjoying that. How would you sort of, you know, from your own perspective, like to see the books continue, and how sort of Dickens' legacy continues through years? Because obviously right now, you know, you could argue that a lot of his messages are more prominent than ever. So how, you know, how would you sort of like to see these texts continue through the future?
I love reinterpretations of it. And people often expect, like, family members to be angry about anything being done that changes his book. But I think it has to evolve. The whole point with Dickens is he was... wanted to be an actor. He never intended to be a novelist. And all his books were written with the theatre in mind. A bit like today, an author might write a novel hoping it's going to get turned into a film or TV series. But Dickens wrote thinking about character. So when he did dialogue, for example, we know that he looked at himself in the mirror, spoke the words, looked at the shape of his face, looked at what his body language was doing, and worked out whether that dialogue would work in a novel or novella. And I think it's so important to have interpretation that people can understand in each succeeding generation. So, for example, there's a hip-hop Christmas carol that's big in Chicago every year. I think that's amazing. There's a Klingon Christmas carol, which I don't think I will ever go to, but I think it's great that it's there. I've seen Oliver Twist done set in the modern day in South Africa, with a filmed in South Africa, with it being in a kind of children's charity in South Africa set. I think it was like in the 1990s, but that was the present day then. Yeah. I think it's so important to bring it to a level that people can enjoy, because in the end, that's what Dickens would have wanted. It's like when you go and watch a comedy version of Christmas Carol. I don't know if any of you have ever seen Blackadder's Christmas Carol, for example. All of these kind of interpretations bring Dickens to a new audience, and that keeps him relevant.
I think the version of Christmas Carol, comedic-wise, I think everyone's more familiar with nowadays, is A Christmas Carol Goes Wrong. I think that one in particular sort of stuck with a lot of people.
Yeah, that's a brilliant. Yeah. Like, general, theatrical interpretation, yeah, but also interpretation through the cameras, with the use of the camera as well, which is how we've all watched it.
Yeah.
Well. Excellent. That's really good to hear.
Yeah.
So I think it's like, I think, like, obviously, as I mentioned before, Christmas Carol has sort of really gone throughout the ages as sort of potentially being, like, his most obviously valued novel, as it were, by the general public, or the one that's made the biggest impact on popular culture.
The one that most people know.
Yeah, the one that most people know.
Yeah.
But is there any other of the major Dickens books you think that deserves a bit more credit in the public light in particular? Or potentially, you know, another shot, a film adaptation maybe?
I think Our Mutual Friend is really brilliant. There was a really good BBC adaptation quite a long time ago. I'm amazed it's never been turned into a film. I don't know if any of you saw the Armando Iannucci David Copperfield about 4 years ago. I think it came out in 2020. He just did it brilliantly. Armando Iannucci managed to take that massive novel, and he is a huge Dickens scholar. He knows that book inside out, and that's how he managed to turn it into a film. But I don't know, maybe your generation didn't like it. Did you like it?
Okay. I have yet to see it. It's on my watch list because I'm a massive fan of Dev Patel, but...
Yeah, and he does it brilliantly.
Patel's brilliant, yeah.
Yeah. It's such a great adaptation, and the reason it's so great is because Armando Iannucci not only is a good writer, but knew his subject really, really well. So he could condense this huge novel into that. I'd love to see him do Our Mutual Friend, which is incredibly atmospheric. I mentioned Barnaby Rudge earlier. I think Barnaby Rudge is lesser known. And just, it's surprising how they always go back to Great Expectations, Oliver Twist, and David Copperfield, and so many of the others just get ignored.
Do you feel that could have an impact in the future, where potentially almost things could start, you know, almost get forgotten about? You know, is there a concern there that potentially people can focus so much on the really big texts, like you mentioned, Great Expectations, and with Dickens, you know, Oliver Twist and A Christmas Carol? Do you think that there's a worry that with the way the world's developing and the way that things are going, that sort of text that maybe people aren't aware of as much or aren't taught in schools could potentially almost, you know, be phased out or sort of just start to get less noticed?
I'm very surprised that hasn't happened already. And what's been intriguing to me is actually the opposite has happened in recent years. So in 2012, there was the bicentenary of Charles Dickens's birth. And I thought that after that, everybody was going to be so sick of Dickens because there were constant adaptations. It just seems to have fanned the flames and made people more interested. Hmm. There's a university project called Dickens Journals Online, which I think has been started by the University of Buckingham. And they have been taking all his lesser-known articles, articles that he wrote and articles that he commissioned, and digitising them. So actually, I think digitisation process is going to make Dickens more accessible to more people. Many people don't realise that Dickens wrote journalism, and yet he stayed writing journalism, not just when he started in his literary career, but right to the end of his life. And that's starting now, thanks to Dickens Journals Online, or djo.org if you want to look it up. By the way, their search facility at the moment is not very good, but just persevere, it will get better. It's a really interesting concept because it's making people realise that he wrote other things. And one of the biggest things we're all discovering is that each successive generation reads much, much shorter articles, ideas, and people don't necessarily want the great big books, but they might be more interested in reading an article or a short story, of which he wrote many.
Yeah. I hope to touch upon that, actually. You mentioned about with the digitalisation of his writings and things like that. How would you... Obviously, when Dickens wrote, he had no awareness of how any of this would work. And obviously, with the digitalisation of a lot of books and things, it's, you know, things like bookstores are becoming less and less popular and things like that. How do you think he would have felt about the way his books are now used and the way that his texts are able to be so, you know, obviously, I'd feel like maybe he'd be quite happy that that it's more accessible to more people. But then also, would he feel... You know, how would he feel about the impact it can have on bookshops and publishers with physical texts?
Yeah, I mean, I would like to say here, do use local bookshops or they will disappear. And I think Dickens, like all authors, would regret the loss of the bookshop. But also, you're absolutely right that I think he would have loved digitisation. In fact, I think it's a really good thing that Dickens wasn't alive in the age of social media, because he wouldn't have got any other writing done. He'd have spent all his life on Instagram and Twitter or Blue Sky or whatever, and just trying to, you know, get the word out there. But I think it's a really fascinating concept that his works will live on in the future. But I also think that I'm noticing when I'm on the tube now, more people are reading actual books than have done for years. And to me, it's interesting how they slowly seem to be coming back. Still see people reading Kindles, most people are looking at their phones, but increasingly people are reading books. And I've had more people say to me, I'm getting bored with looking at a screen.
Yeah.
I want to read a book. So I'm hoping, maybe it's naive, but I'm hoping there might actually be an upsurge in people reading books again. And particularly with all of us, eye problems are going to become a huge issue. Yeah. Everybody spends their whole life looking at screens.
So yeah, absolutely.
At some point, people are going to go, yeah, I'm going to look at books.
Yeah, obviously, there's a sense of irony within that it's kind of, it's almost people sort of so overstimulated by the phones and reading things on Kindles and things like that, that it's almost like they're returning back to, you know, it's almost you could argue almost nostalgic, you know.
Yes.
As a child, you know, kids, you know, the obviously the children now, parents will give them an iPad or a Kindle and they'll be reading off that. But obviously, even when we were children, I had a huge bookshelf when I was a kid.
Yeah.
So
it's
almost longing for that. Maybe also it feels a lot more personal when you're reading from an actual book, isn't it? You can carry that around, and the book sort of ages with as you read it as well. So there's a lot.
And I think with really little children, you can't get that experience of reading together as a parent and child with a Kindle or an iPad, because you need to kind of sit there embraced by the book. You know, the book open. Children like turning pages. Those kind of things, I think, will hopefully keep at least babies and little children's books going. It's when you get to that kind of, you know, older primary school where everybody wants to have their own Kindle or whatever.
It's definitely sort of the tactility of books, I think, really helps during that sort of childhood development stage.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would also like to point out, by the way, I have noticed this the more I've gone into bookshops recently, but I feel like in general there is starting to become like a more culture around physical books, because obviously I've started to notice... oftentimes you'll get like little posters beneath, I don't know, like random sections saying perfect for book talks. I think it's interesting to see like how sort of how social media has sort of encouraged the return to books as sort of like a community, maybe.
I think that's really true. And book talk is huge. And I think as well that you can't show such a beautiful object on your Kindle or your phone. So they've started to create very lovely kind of jackets
like
that aren't just
physical editions.
Yeah, exactly.
It's the same. It's sort of similar with the music industry and records and stuff. It's like limited edition vinyl. Mm-hmm. It's very, you know, that's sort of booming back again as well.
I think records is a really good example that suddenly people are buying record players and they're buying records and not just wanting, you know, to have it on digital. And also, you know, we've all been there where you've suddenly lost everything. You know, suddenly all your music disappears and you think, a minute, that cost me a hell of a lot of money and they've decided to change format, or I've stopped my subscription to that one. So it's, I think people are frightened of that kind of thing. You know, if you've got a subscription to a book service and then for any reason, you know, you don't want to pay it, then you lose all the stuff that you've carefully built up.
Yeah.
Booksellers apparently have, sorry to interject, but
that's
they've reported that The folio type editions, or the ones with gilt edged, are really becoming popular, a collector's item.
Yeah.
Because people want the tangible product. They want it to look nice to give us a present.
Brilliant. This is good news. Mm. Yes. We need your generation to keep buying books.
Yeah.
They always talk about, there's always a lot of talk on social media around this time of year, that the Danish tradition, which apparently is a Danish tradition, I did ask a Danish friend, of giving a book or books on Christmas Eve is a symbol, there's something that's starting to be adopted here. It's a kind of, you know, idea that the Danes are this very literary society, but more and more people are talking about it, and I found myself looking, thinking, which books am I going to buy for everyone for Christmas Eve this year? And I love that in a very short space of time more people are talking about that, so maybe it's something we could start adopting.
Yeah,
and then you get a present to open on Christmas Eve as
well. Absolutely,
which is always important.
Definitely. Yeah, you'll what your appetite for the next day.
To wrap up, I want to ask, you know, do you have any messages for students or advice to students studying Dickens?
I would say that Dickens's message is really important for today as it was then, because what Dickens wrote about was social injustice. And sadly, we still have a huge amount of social injustice, and arguably more than ever happening now than there has been in the last few decades. So a really important thing to remember is how Dickens managed to change the world in which he lived by writing. So don't just dismiss him as some boring old Victorian who isn't relevant. But actually, if you look at his journalism, as well as the causes that he espouses in his novels, you'll see how important it is to keep writing alive and to always be, as he was, a thorn in the side of those in power, because they knew that he was more popular than they were and they couldn't silence him. Today, people would try and silence somebody, but just don't let that happen to you.
Okay, great. Thank you. Fantastic. Thanks for your time. Absolutely. Thank you very much for your time. Obviously, I've been James.
I'm Owen.
I've been Luca.
I've been Logan.
And this has been Lucinda Dickens. Thank you very much for listening. Tune in next time, if there is a next time.